Welcome to the George C. Marshall Center's Strategically Speaking. This podcast series explores the future of NATO in an era of global change. Join us as experts shed light on the challenges and evolution of the Atlantic Alliance. Stay tuned for insightful discussions on international security and NATO's path forward.
A warm welcome to the Marshall Center's podcast series on NATO at 75, the future of the Atlantic Alliance in tumultuous times. I am Fritz Rademacher, Professor of International Security. My co-host today is Leon Runier, an esteemed member of our Marshall Center Alumni Scholar Group research project on NATO after Vilnius, who is joining us from Zagreb. Leon, welcome. And thank you so much for your excellent paper on NATO Allies Defense Industrial Base, which will be part of our book publication in cooperation with the Doctrine and Training Center of the Polish Armed Forces in time for the Washington Summit.
Thank you, Professor Rademacher. It's a pleasure to be with you here today, and especially with our esteemed guest.
It is a great privilege for me to introduce our distinguished guest today, His Excellency Ambassador Mario Nobilo, the permanent representative of the Republic of Croatia to the North Atlantic Council and current dean, who is joining us from NATO headquarters in Brussels. Ambassador Nobilo is an accomplished diplomat with a distinguished career in the foreign service of his country, including inter alia as former Croatian permanent representative to the UN in Vienna and New York, in top-level positions at the ministry, and as advisor to the president. He's also a well-established and widely read scholar with numerous publications to his name. He holds doctorates in law and political science. Ambassador, welcome to our podcast series. It is great to see you again, and thank you so very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us today. We are recording this session on 28 March 2024, just a few days prior to the NATO Foreign Ministerial meeting on 3 and 4 April, which will commemorate the signing of the Washington Treaty by the 12 founding members 75 years ago. Clearly, Ambassador, we are experiencing challenging, even tumultuous times. You have been Croatia's permanent representative to the North Atlantic Council since 2017, I believe, and dealt with alliance issues long before. When you look back at those years, how would you describe the evolution of or changes to the strategic environment during that time, what the alliance has been doing about it?
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to your podcast, and nice to see you again. Indeed, I'm happy to share some thoughts on those developments and my personal experience in those 7 years as permanent rep of my country to the NAC. And I have to say the world had changed tremendously in those 7 years. We have lived certain inner crises of NATO when some leaders were, you know, talking about NATO being brain dead and out of touch and purpose. And the NAC aggression by Russia on Ukraine had brought a new unity, had expanded the NATO in the north, and also have faced us with completely new challenges in our defense and deterrence policy. To a certain extent, the NATO is back to its Cold War factory features. It's more united, of course, but it's more looking how to not only help Ukraine, but also how to prevent further wider conflict on European soil, which means that we have not only have solidarity with Ukraine, but also we have to strengthen our defense on eastern flank. And the most of the reforms that we are now undertaking since Vilnius are in that direction. NATO still perceives threats from 360 degree and is dealing with that area. But I have to say the current situation has forced us from looking more to European continent and inward looking, facing the threats from the east, than we used when we had time of acting out of area in former Yugoslavia, then later in Afghanistan, when we actually were trying also to, in other parts of neighboring region, project stability by training, cooperation, and other issues. And it's more contracted alliance that is stronger, bigger in numbers, etc., but undergoing serious reforms. This new new security paradigm, it's very important to underline that we have to recognize that world has become multipolar, and that this is a reality and we have to coexist. But you understand that the international system as we knew it only 5-10 years ago is collapsing. There's less rule of law. There are more autocracies in the world. They probably dominate in numbers. And also arms control systems are collapsing. So this is completely a new paradigm in which we operate now.
Thank you very much indeed. Perhaps if I may, I would pose a follow-up question to you related to the last part of your remarks, the new security paradigm. Perhaps you can elaborate a little bit on Russia's aggression and overall stance, the pressures we see on our open societies and the rules-based international order, but perhaps also on what is being called the strategic competition, including the role of China.
Well, there's a paradox that as we are contracting to European theater and trying to resolve Ukrainian crisis and prevent a spillover without NATO being directly involved with the truth, but assisting on national level the Ukraine, we have also to have a wider look at the picture, and the global picture is also pretty grim. We have a terrible war in Gaza, and we also have a new wave of terrorism all over. And of course, we have other wars going on in Sahel. There are worrisome tendencies with maritime security in the Red Sea, and now again off Somali coast with pirates attacking ships again. So these are all worrisome tendencies and force NATO to not to get global. We would still continue to be a North Atlantic alliance, but have awareness about the surrounding crises that come to us in different forms. So terrorism, illegal migrations, threat to maritime security, underwater cables, and everything that makes daily life go on. So we have to be global to the sense that problems are coming to us, but our focus is, of course, and continues to be in Northern Atlantic region.
Thank you very much. Over to you, Leon.
Ambassador, thank you once again for being with us today in my own name. Seeing as we are mere months away from the historic Washington summit, I would seek to steer our discussion in this direction. What are the main expectations of the summit in your view? What are the key themes that need to be covered and measures that need to be taken in order to declare the summit a success?
There are several issues that are going to obviously dominate at this anniversary summit. The fact is that it's not only anniversary summit, but it's also election years, not only in the host country, the US, but all over the globe. We have elections in so many countries, including in my country as well, our country as well. And this is, of course, in the shadow of this anniversary. The world is at the crossroad in so many ways. The European elections this year, and we are looking very much into an unknown future, if not uncertain. So we have to take that account, and this would, in a way, influence the atmosphere at the summit. The other aspect is that while the situation in Ukraine continues to be a threat, we are looking for the ways how to find a formula in which we would make Ukraine de facto member of NATO by preparing it for the future defense of the country and finding a way to have a bridge missions or cooperation, which will streamline the current patchwork of assistance that we are giving to Ukraine, would make Ukraine more interoperable and capable to conduct domestic reforms to be one day also a member of NATO, and we hope also of the EU. So these are dominant issues in which we would be focusing, including how to implement the package of reforms that we already agreed in Vilnius. Now it's more the way how we implement the package and the new strategic concept, because we have to put, you know, details to it, numbers to it, financing, and all that. And it's not going to be an easy process, not only because we are 33 now, but we are talking about quite a different geopolitical situation, also different financial figures related to it, much more common funding, much more authority being given to NATO military authorities in the future, strengthening in a real terms the eastern flank and fighting also other phenomena like piracy, terrorism, and as well. So these would be dominant issues. We are also aware that the South, we have quite a number of partners, is also projecting instability into our area, that we are not the most popular organization there. So we have to see how we can, on one hand, be pragmatic in trying to find a common ground on international security, but also how we can explain our goals to our partners and to the rest of the South, which is probably not antagonistic, but neutral or suspicious about what NATO does in neighboring areas.
Now, Ambassador, thank you. This is a great introduction to my next question. To build upon your answer and focus on a specific point, which I believe is on everybody's mind, how do you see the development of Ukraine's relationship with Euro-Atlantic institutions, primarily NATO, but also the EU and other Western bodies, in the coming period and in the long term? What model do you believe represents a realistic long-term relationship between Ukraine and the Euro-Atlantic community in its broader sense?
Everybody is aware that the current stalemate on the front line requires even more assistance from national level, but coordinated ones from NATO towards Ukraine, not only to hold the line, but also to prevail in the future. But we also are aware if NATO steps in, it would probably cause major conflict with Russia that can escalate beyond conventional forms. And we are trying to find this fine line in which we operate. It means that under different conditions, of course, we would respect the sovereign wish of Ukraine to join NATO, but it's politically not realistic because it carries too high risk for further and direct escalation with NATO and Russia. And we are creative in finding the way to make Ukraine organically linked to Western economic, defense, security, any kind of structures which would make it a viable society and more safer in the future. So we are coming up with the ideas how the future defense and deterrence of Ukrainian forces should look like, to try to provide them assistance, training, and financing, which would make Ukraine self-sufficient to be a deterrent to any future attempts to attack it or beyond Ukraine as well. So this is our approach and this point. It is a realistic one and understood also by Ukrainians. They are more focused on pragmatic cooperation to resolve this crisis. But, you know, the final decision on NATO membership would very much be linked to the end of war and eventual evolution in Moscow, which is on a long run. But again, NATO is not looking to for the enemy in the East or trying to antagonize Russia yet. This is such an issue of principles, international law, and humanitarian cause that we have to support. So there would be new ideas, of course, at the summit. We are discussing them right now, in a couple of days on ministerial level. It is still in early stages, but it's going to be a creative way how to bridge this gap between the membership and Article 5, which we cannot extend on this point, and ability of Ukraine to westernize, resist, and restore its sovereignty.
Thank you, Ambassador. So now to turn to a slightly different but very much connected issue, and to try and delineate the roles of the United States and the European NATO allies in this undertaking of supporting Ukraine, but in also in NATO more generally. Given the challenges that the United States faces in other theaters, such as the Indo-Pacific, and the escalation of the tensions in the Middle East, which you referenced earlier, what role must Europe, or more specifically European NATO states, play at the Washington summit?
Well, everybody is aware that without the U.S., there is no proper way to defend Europe still, you know, in spite of the fact that we are strengthening military security cooperation within the EU and also strengthening the European pillar within NATO. Those dilemmas of duplicity and European army versus NATO, they are not anymore an issue. People understand that we are in this together, that European stronger pillar of NATO is necessary in war and peace, and that Europe has to take a bigger share and burden on for its own defense, not only because US is a global power and has some other pivots to deal with, but also because not self-sufficiency, but stronger Europe would be a deterrent, and that pillar would provide more security for the entire alliance. Also, we have to be aware that there has been always a tendency in American foreign policy throughout the history of isolationism, and we should be aware that depends on who wins at the forthcoming U.S. elections, foreign policy would to a certain extent change, though there are some constant U.S. Interest in Europe which would not fade away easily. But the methodology can change, and also less predictability might occur. So we have to substitute for that eventual uncertainty where U.S. would stand after any elections. So these are realities that Europe is capable to cope with. I don't believe it would be easy to see a European army being built, but there would be more division of work within Europe on military industry, on burden sharings, on specific tasks given to specific nations in European defense. There would be more serious approach to military mobility and more solidarity within Europe.
Thank you, Ambassador. To build further on your answer to the previous question, allow me to turn our focus to the topic of deterrence and defense in the North Atlantic, which of course is NATO's core task. Now, during the post-Cold War period, and I would say until 2014 at the earliest, NATO allies believed to be in the midst of the so-called peace dividend. This was a time where NATO was directing its focus to out-of-area operations, focusing on asymmetrical threats, and believed itself to be in an era of relative peace. Now, by 2022, at the latest, we received this rude wake-up call back to reality. In your view, has NATO's transformation away from classical defense to out-of-area operations after the end of the Cold War proven to be a mistake? Were we wrong to believe in the peace dividend?
We were not wrong, because that was the spirit of the time, so to say. And Russia at that time was much more cooperative. I remember even when we have our homeland war, Russia was not a biggest obstacle to our efforts to liberate the country. On the contrary, I mean, even we got the warning when presidential palace was bombed, and we hardly survived, a couple of us, of that bombing. We were warned by the Soviets at that time that it's going to happen and could take measures. And also they were pretty much cooperative within the Security Council. It was a different kind of Russia, Russia that was willing to more to cooperate. But today, I mean, it's back to territorial grab, and it's back to forceful restoring of its past Soviet glory, and back to those ideas of spheres of influences, buffer zones, and all that, which is, of course, obsolete, but realistically exists. So we were enjoying a peace dividend, because we also thought that this peace dividend would also be projected to Russia. It would help Russia to strengthen its democratic institution links itself economically with the West and globally, and we would have more harmony in international relations. We were into business of trying to create those conditions where not only the East but also the South would profit from less emphasis on war, armament, security issues, and focusing on reforms, economy, social issues. Those times are disrupted now. The problem is that in this process, we don't have now one center of decision-making like Russia on, say, arms production, ammunition production. It's more or less private industry. And it takes time to speed up that revival of military industries in Europe. Also, we have a democratic process, and we have to agree among 32 in EU 27. That is all time consuming, and also our reactions are usually delayed ones. But at the end of the day, we come back with strategic answers, and I'm pretty confident that it was a proper policy for that time, because there was no immediate threat, and there was a hope in the world that the world as such, through globalization, is progressing, that human rights are more and more embodied in those societies, and that we would, as they were hoping, be seeing an end of history. Unfortunately, the very cold geopolitics of Rimland Herdon is back on the scene and killing people in tens and hundreds of thousands.
Speaking of, Ambassador, speaking of NATO's transformation to out-of-area operations, of course, since 2014, and especially since 2022, we have been transforming back, in a way, to our core task of deterrence and defense. Do you believe this process is going quickly enough? And a connected question, in terms of our capability to transform ourselves, if tomorrow a new threat were to arise, given the experience of this transformation, what would you say? Do we have the political will and the institutional flexibility to undergo a transformation if it is necessary?
Well, you know, as I already said, we have the democratic process going on and consensus building within NATO, EU, and it takes time, and etc. And while we are very concerned about developments in Ukraine, and is also dragging our resources, which would otherwise be used for a green transition, social issues, etc., solidarity within the members. It is unfortunate, but true, that we have to change and pay more attention to security. It at the same time doesn't mean that we have to switch to war economy. We are not in that situation or stage at this point, it is, of course, easier for Putin to take decisions and he switched to the war economy. But in the mid and long run, and the society and the economy suffers from non-productive production of military equipment, which is spent on destroying and killing. So essentially, we are slower than the situation needs, but it's also in our genes, so to say. We're democracies. We respect the processes of consensus building, but we will get there. And if the threat is very direct to us, I think also we would be taking measures and the public opinion became less relaxed and ignorant about the events that we are talking about now.
Ambassador, ever since Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014, NATO has been strengthening its posture on its eastern flank, especially now with the joining of Sweden and Finland. The flank is stronger than it's ever been. From a political perspective, how do you see this posture developing in the future? Have we done all we can? Is there much left to do? How do you see the future of the eastern flank?
The decision is not only to have a symbolic enhanced forward presence, which is sending certain political messages, but having much harder presence, much more fortified, much more synchronized, and much more robust presence of NATO in allied territories. This is the future, and we are working very much on military mobility, on all necessary logistics for the effort. The trouble is that as we all are trying to reach 2% and 20%, we are also spending on one hand on Ukraine, on the other to refurbish our military stock, which are deflated by the war in Ukraine, and that takes lots of money. So we are doing lots of things in parallel, and which slows the process a bit. But we are getting there. Even if there are some political changes in Moscow, it will take time to change that set of mind. And there are spheres of influences that some countries don't exist, that they have limited sovereignty. That will take time to change, and it would pose a longer threat to us, whoever rules in Moscow, because of that. On the other hand, I mean, we still have to prepare for the times when we would have to deal again with the same Russians of, say, issues like arms control, disarmament, early warning systems, all that is now being undermined or non-existent, which makes the situation even more dangerous than during the Cold War, which was tense, but it was cold and it was kind of regulated by agreed mechanism of verification, early warning, so that any incident or mistake is recognized as such and dealt with. And so we would have to prepare for the time when common European security, that issue have to be revisited.
Thank you, Ambassador. Let me now turn to a topic which gets much less media coverage, but is of vital importance in my view, both in terms of supporting Ukraine and ensuring security in the Euro-Atlantic space. And that is, of course, the topic of fair burden sharing and reconstituting the alliance's defense industrial base. When it comes to the issue of burden sharing in the alliance, of course, the 2% and 20% rules established at the summits of Wales and Warsaw, do you believe the member states will be able to maintain their political will necessary to keep promises made? You referenced this in your earlier comment, the eternal debate in democracies between guns and butter, or between social spending and military spending. If, for instance, the current threat situation were to calm down or go away, do you believe we will continue to invest in our defense? Have we been taught a lesson with the events in Ukraine?
Well, we will, because even if this threat is gone, the direction of threat might change in the future. And I believe that what this crisis had taught us is that, of course, we have to put heads together, have unity, NATO is stronger and bigger. All that is very positive. And but on the same time, people and governments understand you have to be also a strong part of that alliance. If, for example, a Strij fell on Zagreb, then we realize we don't have a defense system capable to deal with that situation. We are now investing in it. But essentially, we understand it's not always the NATO that has to solve the problem. You are the first line of defense, and then NATO would jump in to assist you in the effort. This is a rule that is now applied for bigger and smaller countries, say Baltic countries or others. They understand that they have to take the first charge, so to say, and there is something permanent in the security field that has to be developed and follow technological developments. So I don't believe even in the most optimistic scenario of different Russia and a peace in Ukraine that we would pay then less again attention to the security issue, arms industry and all that. It's really worrisome that takes us so long and that we have so little artillery shots, for example, and relative low base to draw from in case of sudden or unpredictable developments. So there would be investment. Of course, part of that would be in new technologies, but that's not always the answer. We have to have more resilient societies, and the approaches like all of the government to this security would become dominant. Some countries would restore to the partial conscript base, but the others would also try to strengthen overall resilience of the societies, which could help us not only in case of war, but other disasters of natural origin. So resilience is becoming an important topic in our security discussion.
Ambassador, one can hear various speculations in the media as always, but how would you address this thesis, which sometimes is applied, which is that there is perhaps fatigue in terms of support for Ukraine within the alliance?
You know, I mean, in every war, there is a fatigue. There's a fatigue in Ukraine, there's a fatigue in Russia, there was fatigue in our war. You know, people wanted to end it. That's natural. But I don't believe that the West would abandon Ukraine just because of fatigue, you know. It is not realistic because the threat is huge and consequences for us, economic migration, terrorism, insecurity are great. And so I don't believe that we would give up on this. I mean, this is unreasonable to expect. And even in the worst case scenario that, I mean, for us, the major problem currently is that the role of the country too that has a specific interest are blocking decision making within democracies and in consensus building. There we lose more time than on real political wills as where to proceed. But again, this is too huge, too important, and it's not going to get away, and we are not going to give up.
Now, to echo a question I posed earlier, but in a different and more focused way, given the fact that it is Europe which is facing a degradation of its security architecture rather than our allies in North America, how much of a burden in terms of reconstituting the defense industrial base must be borne by European industry, and what is the role of NATO-EU cooperation in this regard? We have seen a plethora of initiatives, the NATO Defense Production Action Plan, the US National Defense Industrial Strategy, as well as the European Defense Industrial Strategy and the proposed European Defense Industry Program. But how do we put them all together, and how much of this burden should be borne by European allies?
You know, every crisis is also an opportunity, and the opportunity is that if we have to put more money into our security and strengthen our defense forces, then we have to have those protection. The issue here is that the logic of it is that we have to have more standardized equipment, NATO standardized, easy to operate with similar systems, have more interoperability in general. But at the end of the day, it is very important that Europe get its share of the cake, so to say. It is not logical from even logistic point of view, in case of major war, that we are waiting for U.S. convoys like in World War II to rearm us and supply us. We have to have those warehouses in our territory closer to a crisis area, and we have to be assisted but not necessarily be saved by anybody. And this is something which Europe is becoming more and more aware. It would not be an issue to find a political will to invest. It is more how we divide the labor, because small countries are only the customers and in most cases, and we have to find a way when the domestic industry or domestic knowledge about certain military equipment is valuable in smaller countries like Croatia, in demining, for example, technology that we have, or some other which are easier and cheaper to produce. And also when it comes to ammunition, obviously that we cannot have only 2-3 producers on the European continent. It's not rational. We have to have it spread all over the European theater, because it would be used and needed by the local forces and not distributed in a vulnerable way in case of crisis. So we have to divide the roles and work in this sense according to geography, certain kinds of possess, and also sometimes invest jointly into putting an ammunition plant somewhere in the Balkans or wherever in the Baltic states close to the eventual front line.
Ambassador, this wouldn't be the first time in your answer you have predicted my following question. I would maybe just pose it anyway if you feel you need anything to add. What would be the role of smaller allied countries in terms of fair burden sharing? I'm specifically talking about countries like ours, like Croatia and other smaller allies. Would this be through multinational, perhaps regional cooperation, or how specifically do you see the role of smaller NATO allies in this context?
You know, if you ask me as a Croatian ambassador, then I would tell you that we are fully aware of the threats from the East, and we express our full solidarity. We have troops in 3 of those countries, and we are a valuable ally to that sense. But our threat to security continues to be our neighborhood, unfortunately. Instability in the Balkans worries more than what's happening in Ukraine. On the other hand, it was Ukraine that helped us when we were under embargo and fighting our war, and we have we remember that. So essentially, for smaller countries, we have different geographic priorities which are not that visible, but we have, you know, instability going on, hybrid war going on against the allies in the region, and we have unfinished business in Bosnia, Kosovo, elsewhere, and that worries us more. So we would, while expressing our solidarity with the situation in a wider picture, have to take care also of our security. Because, you know, people are saying that now Russia has, with Finland, 1,300 kilometers of border, which is dragging Russian troops along it, and our border with Russia is direct. We have the similar or the same length of border with instability in Western Balkans with Serbia and Bosnia and Herzegovina. So it's a challenge for us as well. But again, you can balance that, because if there is a solidarity, you will be assisted. But then again, visibility of Ukrainian crisis is somehow putting those problems, which are crucial for us in the shadow.
Thank you, Ambassador. And with that, I yield the floor to my colleague, Professor Rademacher.
Ambassador, thank you very much for that. And if you have the time, let me follow on to what you have just said about your own region, the Western Balkans. We have seen countries from the region becoming alliance members over the years to the mutual benefit of NATO and the countries concerned, I would say. Nonetheless, challenges, as you yourself just mentioned, remain in and for the region. What are the big ticket items in your view? What can be done about them? And what should NATO's role be?
Well, we thought that after the war ended in Bosnia and also in Herzegovina and also in Croatia, that the issue would evolve automatically. And of course, the region as such is making progress, especially in the way you mentioned. We have new allies joining the NATO. We joined the last country to join European Union, but there is still a lot to be done on Euro-Atlantic path of the entire region that belongs to NATO and belongs to the European Union. Why we have still this unfinished business and why this is still considered an area of instability is a question of deeper analysis. My analysis is that, you know, one party to all the war, the party that started them all, have not passed a proper catharsis on and lessons learned from this conflict. On the contrary, they are exporting instability, insisting on the Russian model of Ruski Svet, Ruski Mir, with Srpski Svet. And this is not a sincere attempt by some of them to join the Western world. And as long as this lack of catharsis exists and people are just buying time and saying, well, I mean, to be more energetic, conditional on this remaining unresolved issues in the Western Balkans, we are narrowing this area, but we have to come to the hard core of the problem. And that is an evolution of Serbia foreign policy and further democratization of Kosovo and Bosnia and Herzegovina. So while there is no immediate threat to renewal of hostilities in a big scale in the Western Balkans, there is a constant instability being projected, hybrid war, proxies' role in the region, which are destabilizing the region and making it even more difficult to finish this job of stabilizing Western Balkans.
Thank you so very much, Ambassador Nobilo. This has been such a pleasure to engage with you today. We are very grateful to you for taking your time and for your most interesting views and invaluable insights. This is indeed such a pivotal moment for the Alliance and for Euro-Atlantic security. Thank you for all the work you're doing at NATO and for the Alliance. We wish you every success in the discharge of your many duties as we are moving towards the Washington summit. Leon, a big thank to you for being such a wonderful co-host today, and good luck with your alumni scholar project and its publication. Thank you also to our listeners. Please stay tuned for the next episodes as we will continue to explore the Alliance's future with senior leaders and officials from NATO and allied and partner countries. Until the next time, goodbye from me, Fritz Rademacher.
Thank you indeed for inviting me.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for joining us on Strategically Speaking, presented by the George C. Marshall European Center for Strategic Studies. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the official policy or position of the George C. Marshall Center, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. We hope today's episode provided valuable insights into NATO's role in today's world. For more content, visit our website at www.marshallcenter.org. Join us next time for more on the unfolding story of NATO.